Once again, welcome to you all. So we have Dr. Alok Pandeyji. I have already given a small introduction about him right in the beginning. So I invite him here to speak on Sri Aurobindo's integral yoga. Dr. Alok Pandeyji.
In one of his poems, Sri Aurobindo compares the soul of man with a tree. It's a very short poem. He writes, "A tree beside the sandy river beach, holding its topmost boughs like fingers to the heaven they cannot reach. This is the soul of man, his body and brain hungry for earth, his heavenly flight detain." This is one of the problems, perhaps the biggest problem that man experiences in his brief sojourn upon earth. Animals live in grooves of habit, submerged by matter, asanna mrityu as it's called. They are happy with the way they are. And the gods are happy in their house of splendor. They believe they need nothing. There is no struggle. There is no suffering, there is no pain, and therefore there is no spur for evolution or going beyond themselves. But man of all the creatures experiences a pull, a tug as it were. On one side, his one leg rooted in animality. On the other side, his head held high, looking towards the sky, towards the heaven. So much so that perhaps it's not insignificant that the word used to describe, one of the words used to describe man, Purusha, is also the word used to describe the one being, the Purusha, whose head is of fire, an infinite fire, whereas his feet are rooted upon earth, Padabhyam Prithvi. And since man has become conscious of himself and of the life around him, his search has been to discover the integrating principle. How to lead a life where there is a balance of earth and the heaven. Sometimes the balance has tilted towards this side and he has lost himself in the mud of earth nature. At times he has taken a flight into the beyond, forgotten earth, forgotten life, forgotten creation, flinging himself in the arms of the Creator and his interminable delight. Yet, most of mankind wants to find some way that they can integrate the two. And I think Vedas are the earliest documents where we see this effort at synthesis. A synthesis of life here and a life which is beyond. And that's what makes them beautiful. They are not a book written and finished, because the Vedas are infinite, their source is infinite. And how can the infinite ever be written completely or uttered fully by any or many human tongues? So Vedas are something which continue to be explored, discovered and renewed. And that's the beauty of the Vedas, that they have carried on. It's an approach towards the infinite. I wouldn't even say an approach towards life. It's an approach towards the infinite. And where is the beginning and where is the end? They are the first documents which as if reveal these secrets in a flashlight, leaving the centuries to explore it in their own unique ways. So it's an effort at synthesizing these two. The eternal Veda, the bud of knowledge, is not confined to a book. It is written in the heart of creation. It is written in the stones. It is written in the minerals. It's written in the plants. It's there in the seas, the skies, the river, the gods, the titans, and above all, the soul of man. There resides, there dwells the Veda. In fact, in a certain sense, all life is an unfolding of this Veda. Sri Aurobindo beautifully says in the synthesis, "The scripture of the eternal, of the integral yoga is, the supreme shastra of the integral yoga is the eternal Veda, secret in the heart of every thinking and living being. And it opens, it's like a bud, it opens. It opens through experiences of life, it opens through every little touch from the beyond, from around us. And as it opens, man becomes enamored more and more of the eternal. And the more he is enamored of the eternal, the more swiftly this bud begins to open, and the eternal Veda, which is the secret knowledge hidden in man's own deepest being, that begins to unfold itself and reveal itself. So Vedas, what we call as Vedas, were the first effort of man to reconcile this paradox of human life, this enigma, which we confront day and night. And that enigma is that on one side there is in us the secret sense of immortality. On the other side we see everywhere a dance of death, beautifully conjured in a small little Indian story, often interpreted in a very Mayavadic sense, but it is a very affirming story. And the story is about Yudhishthir, when he has answered all the questions posed to him by his own father incognito, who comes as Yaksha. And it's a way that he prepares Yudhishthir for his great mission. It is his way of preparing his child. So he asks him one after another. It's like revealing the knowledge to him. And Yudhishthir answers. This was the method used in the Vedic times. So he asks a final question. Tell me, which is the most surprising thing? Kim Ashcharya? And Yudhishthir says, the most surprising is that every day we see death around us, and yet we believe we are immortal. The story is interpreted by the Mayavadins in one way. There is no real immortality. There is only transience. The other way is that despite the dance of death, we have the sense of immortality in us. And this immortality affirms its tread on each and every circumstance of life. That's why when we say we had this program, that's at so and so time, we are going to have this program, and whoever asked everyone, everyone said yes, yes, tomorrow or day after tomorrow at this time. Would we be sure? And yet we are sure. This is the interesting paradox of life. We believe, we trust. We trust immortality more than death. And so the Vedic rishis took this trust as a hint, an intuition as it were, inbuilt in life, and taking this little ray of hope, they started ascending towards the home of immortality. Where does this intuition come in man? Wherefore, this quest is born in us, and they found a path. And this path was a very fascinating path, a path of ascension through the zigzag of the gods, one god after another, Varuna and Mitra, preparing us towards vastness, harmony, love, sweetness, and Ahriman battling against all the forces that oppose our ascension, and Bhag preparing us for the delight, and eventually the house of truth, Surya, who himself pours the nectar of immortality, Soma, and makes us experience the delight of immortality. It's an amazing, wonderful journey where the soul of man becomes, sometimes is visualized as a bird ascending between two firmaments. One, the physical and mental, on the other side, the higher firmaments. And at other times, it's visualized as a warrior battling against all that is dark, opposes its journey, the Valas, the Vritras, the Panis, the Dasyus, and many other names. And this is surely not a book written long back. It is as relevant today. It's so true. It is to be lived and experienced. And every person who undertakes an inner life experiences it. He experiences the wealth of the gods. He experiences the outpourings of the horse of Indra dripping with Gritam. It's an experience which enriches, illumines our mind. He experiences the swift flowing of the Maruts. He experiences the touch of the Ashwins, bringing us fitness and health and vitality to do God's work in the world. This is as much a fact today as it was yesterday and will be as much a fact tomorrow. So the Vedic rishis laid these broad foundations. The mother says they were involutionary beings. They came to set into motion the great truth which is already inbuilt in creation, which will unfold, giving man a law by which to live. But as happens over a period of time, the book became more important than the truth. The rituals become more important than the spirit behind it. So beautifully conjured in the story of Sati. Nowadays, lovely serial is coming, Mahadev. And Sati, thus who embodies the spirit of truth, and Prajapati, not the Prajapati of the Vedic lore, but the Prajapati of the Puranas, who has built lot of laws, he has created lot of laws, rituals, ways of life, Daksha Sahita as it is called, by which man must live. And Sati is in love with the boundless, with the absolute, with the infinite, with the immortal Shiva himself. And this love is one effort at reconciling. Shiva's touch is dangerous. It breaks all the notions, all the trappings, all the limitations of the world of Prajapati. And therefore he can't bear it. Immortality bears ill the eternal's touch, as Shobindra says. So, it's a story where a whole civilization which is built along a very ritualistic way of looking at life breaks down. And Daksha dies, the Yagna is destroyed. It's a wonderful story. But what is the ultimate outcome? Does the quest die? No, Sati does not die. She is reborn. And she is reborn as Parvati. A conscious being who from very birth is ascending. Parvati is the daughter of Himalayas, the peaks of earth nature. She is born on the peaks of earth nature. She is a born Tapaswini. And she prepares and becomes ready to mate with the infinite. So it's an amazing story where the spirit never dies. The spirit of the Vedas continues to live. So many times, so many interpretations, good, bad, right, wrong, it's not really important. Because it's something which is inbuilt, ingrained. We are programmed to use a, you know, modern language. So this was one effort. And then this Veda began to flow out in countless streams. The Tantras, which at some point were regarded as non-Vedic, later came to be accepted as Vedic, Agam Shastra. Because one discovered, yes, the roots are there. Where is the Divine Mother, the Mother of the Gods? She's there in the Vedas. And from there, the roots of Tantra, where one discovered that, no, he is not just the Purusha, but he is also the Shakti that has gone into this creation, Pragya Prasruto Purano, the ancient wisdom. And that is the knowledge which is there within the heart of creation. So it was a wonderful new outpouring, new outflowing. Though of course, historically there were fights and quarrels. Human beings love to fight. And if there's nobody else, they have a fight inside and that gets reflected outside. So let's not go into that part of the history. But the fact is that this too was an outpouring. And yet, as humanity advances, new things come up. New discoveries, new ways of looking at life, new challenges, new problems, new issues. And hence the synthesis has to be once again done. And of course, humanity gets lost in the mechanical understanding of the truth. So the third attempt at synthesis we see is in the Gita, where once again, Shri Krishna, it's amazing, in the dance of death all around, the song of immortality is given. It's an amazing scripture that way. Its whole setting is so mesmerizing. One cannot imagine that a scripture is given of such great relevance and truth, not in a quiet ashrama or in a mountain paradise. It's given on the battlefield. And it's so true. There are real stories, even in war, where people have lived the Gita. It was one attempt to synthesize even the ghor karma, because generally, when we turn to tradition, after a time there comes a divide. There are some karmas which will help us in the great ascension. But there are some karmas which don't help us. They have to be kept away. So there are ghor karmas, battle, killing. It's a ghor karma. How can this karma even help us remotely in ascension? Because this is the eventual journey, this is the eventual challenge. And Sri Krishna presents that, well, not only is this battle within, but there is also this battle which is outside. And even this karma, ghoram karmam, as Arjuna says, that this is my problem, that all that you say is wonderful, but do you know what karma you are asking me to do? So Krishna says, of course, that, well, I have done all the karmas and I can tell you by experience that you can be free even while engaged in ghor karma. And there is a path, there is a way. Of course, the Gita adds the bhakti that is only hinted in the Vedas. Krishna brings it to the forefront. Both it's there in the Gita. Gita, of course, lifts it to sublime heights. And of course, in the lore of Sri Krishna, in the Vrindavan and Bhagavad, we see that bhakti element which is in the Vedas and the Upanishads hinted. When the Rishi says, my submission to the fire, that sense of surrender, he is basically referring to bhakti. But in the Gita, it comes absolutely like a vast sea rushing on the soul from every side. So this is one synthesis. But life doesn't stop. As the Veda unfolds itself through the Vedic lore, through Upanishads, through Tantra and the Gita, new challenges come in. There are new discoveries. There are new problems, new enigmas. Mankind advances materially and psychically. The age of individualism comes. Reason arrives at its acme. Matter is analyzed to its very darkest depths. Its depths are sounded. The atomic energy unveiled. So we need a new synthesis. All this new discovery has to be once again assimilated by the Vedic light, into the Vedic light, and given a fresh understanding, integrated and lived in the light of the Vedic truth. And that is where we see the great work of Sri Aurobindo. There are many other things, of course, besides. But all that transpired between, let's say, the time of the Gita and today, there were questions which Arjuna did not ask or could not ask, which the modern mind is bound to raise. And Sri Aurobindo anticipates these. He takes them up. He gives an importance to matter, which is amazing. Matter is not to be rejected. This is there in the Vedas. But over a period of time, the tendency towards otherworldliness comes. It's understandable. Because as the human soul ascends, its first touches and glimpses of the infinite are so intoxicating, mesmerizing, that who would want after that to really roll in the mud of earth nature? There is a natural tendency to withdraw. Sri Aurobindo says that even he experienced the truth of the Mayavad in his early days, when suddenly the whole city appeared like a floating speck, vanishing like a cinema and shadow before his eyes. While walking casually on the seat of Suleiman, Takhte Suleiman, seat of Solomon, he experienced the vacant infinite, and it's very alluring. As long as we have not glimpsed it, it's still something vague. Absolute, intellectualized philosophy, but one touch of it and we are just bowled over or rolled over or drowned in it. And then to get back to this earth and its harsh realities, painful reality, its struggle of everyday existence is as if a sharp contrast to this inner beatitude. And yet, if that is not done, life on earth will always remain ultimately, in the last analysis, a vanity of vanities, a bad dream from which we wake up. But that's not what the Vedic truth is about. It's taking the challenge of life head on. And if it is full of darkness, all the more reason, as Sri Aurobindo puts it, that if this field of life is dark, all the more reason that children of light and immortality should hurl themselves into it. So we normally give the reverse logic. Oh, this is dark. And therefore, we must escape into the light. On the contrary, we should say, oh, this is dark. Therefore, we carrying the light within us, plunge into it. Beautifully given in one of Sri Aurobindo's poems, The Pilgrim of the Night. We have heard about Pilgrim of Light. Pilgrims are always those who go towards light. Asadoma sadgamya tamsoma jyotirgamya mrityor ma amritam gamya. But what is this pilgrim of the night? And there he says so beautifully, I made an assignation with the night. In the abyss was fixed our rendezvous, carrying in my heart God's deathless light. I came her dark and dangerous heart to woo. This is something unprecedented. Night is frightening. It's full of shadows, darkness. And in the Vedic lore, Indra comes to help the aspiring soul. And what does he do? He destroys Vritra, the mighty serpent which encircles around the city. He destroys Vala, Pani. And yet they come up again and again, like a hydra's head. They are reborn, reborn, reborn. A few escape, but the rest strive on and fail. So why this is so? What is this shadow which every time it is destroyed, it comes up again? We have Ravana and Kansa and many others. The Mahabharata is regarded as a fifth Veda, because the same truths are there in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, but given in a form which is so much easy and palatable to the human mind. And yet they crop up again and again. So is there a solution other than finding a door of escape into the beyond? Can we really reconcile this? And the solution that Sri Aurobindo gives, which is hinted in the Vedas, is transformation. What really does it mean? It simply means that all life, all creation is essentially nothing else but a distorted representation of something which is true. Therein comes the mighty Vakya of Sri Aurobindo in Sri Aurobindo Upanishad. Brahma Satyam Namithya, Jagat Satyam Namithya. As he says in Savitri, it is a dream fact, vision of truth. It doesn't mean that the world as it is in its appearance is true. One has to be really of one set to believe it. But definitely it is the distortion of a truth. And a distortion can be corrected. If it was something which was came up, sprung up by itself, there is no chance, no hope. But it's a shadow of some reality. There is a hope of this distortion being corrected. In the Veda, there is a beautiful hint. When the fire is invoked, the Rishi says, make the crooked straight. Doesn't say burn it down to ashes. Make the crooked straight. May we think that aspire towards the right and the light. Ritam, Satyam, Vratam. So this effort Sri Aurobindo brings to the forefront and makes it the very goal of the yoga. Which means no more the old door of escape into the beyond. Like the Purusha himself, our feet well grounded upon earth. Even there is a beautiful Vedic imagery about the swan whose one foot is upon earth and the other is in the heaven. And if it were to lift up both feet, it would vanish. So this double effort, on one side, the perfection of the soul, its full blossoming, assimilating all these splendors and riches of the beyond, the light, the might, the strength, the truth, the bliss, the peace, all that is not found in this life, to get those riches, inner splendor which the rishis aspired for, cows and horses, go, light, gomati, a luminous mentality, horses, ashwa, the fire, the force, the power of truth, to aspire for all that and accumulate them in the soul. But for what purposes? Not merely to use them to escape, but to hurl ourselves upon the world with all this as the inner riches. To hurl ourselves upon matter, this material life, its manifold relation. That is the real challenge of yoga, the real challenge of reconcile these two. Escape into the beyond is an individual phenomena. We can cut off all other things which are connected with creation. In fact, if that be the goal, then surely that is the best way. But transformation means accepting life upon earth, which means accepting all the manifold hues and colors and shades of our variegated life. All the relationships with human beings, with plants, with animals, with the sun, the moon, everything. And to accept it in grim earnest. To bear it like a cross upon our shoulders. And yet continue to walk. It's a much heavy burden to start with. But as we move on, because naturally in this yoga, one has to accept it. It cannot be rejected. And when we accept it and start, it looks like a heavy burden. Shubhendu says that in this yoga, in the beginning, it looks like, oh, it's very difficult. And that's why many people even find Shubhendu's writings difficult. Forget about the yoga. Though actually it is very easy. Very easy because it's not philosophy. It's everyday life experienced from the highest standpoint. Really, it's an intimate psychology. And as one reads it with that quest, that yes, this is my aspiration, then the pages open and reveal from behind the words the light that is inscribed behind them. That's how the Vedic rishis were mantra drishtas. They saw the mantras written in the ether and received them in their soul. The soul reads it, the soul sees it. For the mind, yes, it's mind-boggling literally. But for the soul, it's simple, straight, direct, touching the root of the problem. When we read the synthesis, right from the beginning, it takes up the problem in real earnest. And he starts with the world panorama as if the Lord is showing us a vast cosmic television. And he says all the world tendencies, the world presents such an image where all the world's tendencies and forces are put in a cauldron of media, the Greek magician, sorceress. And they are being put so that either they will burn away or they will survive after purification. So here also in this yoga, all these things, all our diverse tendencies and habits of nature and ways of being, our living, all with all the countless imperfections, shades of darkness are put in the huge cauldron, but not of just media, but of the Mother Divine. So this is something very, very interesting that Shubhendu brings out. For the first time we have in the history of, spiritual history of earth, the avatar puts the Shakti in front and steps behind. Avatars have always come with Shakti. But Radha is left in Vrindavan because the earth is not ready for the divine love. Sita goes back into the earth because the world is not ready for the divine marriage between the soul and earth nature. Man doubts her purity because it has been usurped by the Asura. Buddha comes and he has to leave behind. He has to forget Sujata, whose hint shows him the path, the luminous path. Something which even the great sages could not tell him. He is struggling for years and there comes the Divine Mother and tells him, don't keep the bow so tense that it snaps, nor so lax that it cannot, you know, shoot an arrow. And Buddha knows, who else is she but the Divine Mother who comes and goes away. Because his path is a path which in that context is important. Madonna comes, Magdalene, and she has to be relegated to the background. Humanity cannot accept that Christ the avatar can be guided by the Divine Mother herself. This has been the history of earth. And yet when Shubhendu comes, he puts the mother in front because now it is time for a new creation. Let a new word be spoken from the heights and one great act unlock the doors of fate. All this to be put in her huge cauldron, not just individually. That was still easy. A yoga of escape, of nirvana, of moksha can be an individual yoga. In fact, by its very nature, it's an individual yoga. It starts with collectivity but ends with an individual. But this yoga, by its very nature, is collective yoga. If transformation of life upon earth has to be there, we have to accept all our fellow beings, whether we like them or don't like them, good, bad, ugly, everything together. We become part of one great ship of King Satyavrat, of the Pralaya fame, where all the samples are put in a ship and they are to cross over to the next stage. So here also, there are several challenges that one has to take up in this yoga, because transformation is not an individual process. Shubhendu and the mother at the very beginning, because even if an individual was to transform himself, he would be a freak. To start with, it's impossible because it would not be a change of the law of earth nature. It would be a superimposition of another law. Like somebody can keep nowadays doctors, I'm a doctor by profession, so they can prolong life for months Some people are in coma for years and they're living. It's because something else has been superimposed, a power of matter which is different and it can help prolong life. Similarly, yogis are known to superimpose the pran tattva, the power of life, and prolong life. Shobindo recounts an incident where he met Swami Brahmanand of Chandod. There are many similar names, not of Sri Ramakrishna Math, who was himself a great yogi, but of Chandod. And it was said that he was more than 200 years old, that he had fought the battle of, he was there even during the battle of Palasi. And he is there, and he would hardly open his eyes, and when Shobindo went, he opened his eyes. Now those possibilities are there, but they are not transformation, they are superimposition of a higher law onto a lesser law. It's like encapsulating a body and preserving it in a controlled environment. But in this yoga, it cannot be by its nature a controlled environment. Everything, life is conterminous with every other life. We are not cut off into separate segments. We believe it. But one of the first things that we discover when we enter into the path of yoga is the truth of oneness. And it hits hard. We discover that yes, indeed it is the one with many masks. We may not like a person, but he is still the one. Even in rags, I am divine. That's how Shobindo puts in one of the stories. Also there in some very interesting Sufi experiences. Yaar ko humne ja baja dekha, kabhi zahir, kabhi chipa dekha. I am seeing my beloved here and there, everywhere. Sometimes hidden, sometimes he is in front. So this state of the one, oneness, immediately we awaken to a consciousness that all these seemings of separateness is a play. This oneness is a deeper truth. But holding this oneness, one has to start rediscovering the pattern of life, the dharma, the Sanatan Dharma. The Sanatan Dharma is built on oneness, on yagna. The yagna comes because there is oneness. If there is no oneness, there is no yagna. By its nature, life is one. And therefore, regardless of whatever efforts we may do, the results will be based on the collectivity. I may do some effort, but somebody else may reap the reward. I may put in efforts, but somebody else may succeed. And equally, somebody else is doing effort, but I am succeeding. Because the prasadam which is given, the gift of the yagna, is not just to few. Of course, those who do directly the yagna become recipient of special gifts. But it is given to all. In a typical yagna, there is the hota, the priest, and there are others, the head priest and the other priest. And the sacrifice is being performed. And at the end of sacrifice, there are people who are watching. They are just silent participants. And when the yagna is over, they all get something or the other. This is collective yoga. That some do the yoga and the gifts come to whole earth and entire mankind. That's why very often people ask that why in Shobindo's ashram we don't have free hospitals, free dispensaries. Well, we have something which is free and that is light and delight. But it's unfortunately not valued. Free peace. Walk into the ashram. No money asked. No special darshan. No deluxe darshan. And you know, everything is free. Probably too free to be believed. Too good to be true. And yet we walk samadhi so unimposingly. Many people take their chappals right very close. And they walk in not knowing what's going to hit them. So this is the real gift. Freedom from ignorance. But not just for one or two. And it has a ripple effect. Everyone who is engaged in this yoga, knowingly or unknowingly, consciously or unconsciously, helps everyone else. Mother used to say, win your little victories. Your little victories will become milestones for the earth. It's a quiet little victory, trying to conquer greed for one rasgulla, sweetmeat. One person tries it and suddenly many persons begin to feel, oh, after all, it's not such a big deal to get rid of sweets. It's amazing. This is one dimension of this yoga, collective yoga. So in the beginning, it appears like a big burden because here we don't walk alone. Even if we think we are walking alone, we are not alone. Because it's not a truth of life and creation that we are alone. It's an illusion of created by nature for a certain purpose. We are never alone. We are always surrounded by the One, and that One is infinite. He holds within Himself everything. So how can one be alone? So as we walk slowly to start with this, but the way very simple. All that we have to do is to keep unburdening. And as we unburden, to whom? The Divine Mother is there to receive us. And as we grow in consciousness, she becomes vaster and vaster and vaster. She who was in the beginning came to us simply a giver of some small boons. People go and approach the Divine Mother for their joint pains and, you know, for relief from fever. And she says, fine. This is the starting point. And then we begin to offer our inner tendencies and habits. And then we begin to offer all the contamination and contagion. Then we begin to offer all those who are connected with us. Every little object of life, the water that we drink and we bathe in, the toothpaste with which we brush our teeth, the food we eat, the bed on which we sleep, the pillow, and slowly everything begins to become one vast offering. It is like a volcanic fire which begins to rage and burn down every impurity. It's a new kind of relation with life. To start with, everything was meant for us. Creation for us, people for us, God for us, yoga for myself. It's, after all, I have to find my own mukti. And then a point comes when we begin to discover, no, me for God, creation for God, he for God, she for God, creation for God, everything that I do for God and for God alone. It's a complete change of orientation. Nothing is left, yet everything is newly discovered. Beautifully conjured in one of these stories of the Upanishads, which Sri Aurobindo refers to in the synthesis of yoga when he talks about the ascent of the sacrifice of the Yajna, is the story of Yajnavalk. He had Katyayani and Maitreyi. And Katyayani, when he was to go for a kind of intense sadhana, he divided his property equally between Katyayani and Maitreyi. So Katyayani says, yes, it's fine for me, fine with me. I don't doubt you. Whatever you have done is perfect. And Maitreyi says, what will I do with this property? You give me that which is so dear to you that you are able to just part with this property just like that and go away. So he says, he tries to, you know, dilly-dally, Maitreyi, it's not such a simple, yogic knowledge. No, give me a hint, a clue. Give me some hint so that I can live the rest of my life with that knowledge. He still dilly-dallies. Then Maitreyi asks a direct question. Tell me, you know, sometimes we ask this question, do you love me? So he says, she puts it indirectly. She says, why does a man love a woman? Why does a man love his children? Why does a man love his country? Why does someone love this creation and its different elements? So now Yajnavalk has to spill out the beans, the secret of his life. You know, he is the Isha Upanishad is attributed to this great rishi. And he says, Maitreyi, one does not love the wife for the sake of the wife, but for the sake of the self. One does not love the child for the sake of the child, but for the sake of the self. One does not love the country for the sake of the country, but for the sake of the self. And so on and so forth. Now, the beauty of this story is, it's often interpreted that, yes, it's an egoistic love. Therefore, you have to abandon everything. But Sri Aurobindo gives this story a beautiful inner turn. He says, as long as we are in the lower nature, as long as we are leading an egoistic life, our love is also egoistic. And we love people for the sake of our ego. They are mine. And the moment this mine changes, the person whom we loved, even children towards whom we love, you know, human beings have a natural love, all creation, because it's a shadow of the love of the Divine Mother herself for creation. It's the most intense love, deepest love. And yet when children reject their parents, this love begins to change into something acrid, bit bitter, not very good taste. But there is another kind of love. And Shobindo says, if we can love them for the sake of the lesser self with a small s, or when we have discovered the greater self, this love also changes its quality. We love people, we love creation, we love everything for the sake of the greater self, because they too are the divine manifesting, and relation changes. And we begin to lead a truly Vedic life, the life of the Vedic sages, where they discovered the oneness, the interconnectedness of this entire creation. They discovered the warp and woof of existence. Now, this does not mean only a sentimental kind of rosy love. No, it's a very powerful love. The love of Mahakali, which can destroy creation if need be, and yet it is love. The love of Krishna, which declares on the battlefield of Kurukshetra that the one who loves the Lord has Maitri and Karuna in him. And O Arjuna, with all the compassion in your heart, and if you truly have compassion, lift your bow and fight this great battle. It's an amazing paradox. Can we fight with all the love and compassion in our heart? Yes, because we have to destroy the forms. The truth is never destroyed. When certain forms, whether individual or collective or civilizational, they become petrified, obstinately standing in the way of light and truth, they must go. And someone has to do this job of cleaning the dirty linen, whether publicly or otherwise. In this yoga, we clean this linen inside. It's a process of purification. And who purifies us? In the Vedas, we have these seven streams. Ila, Mahi, Saraswati, Sarma. And countless names in the Puranas. We have Ganga, Yamuna. All these are streams which come and purify us. And here we have the origin of all streams, the Divine Mother herself. And the more we offer something, after all, this is what yoga is about. Bringing the lower in contact with the higher. The Vedic rishis used to rub the two pieces of wood, keeping one on top and the other below, and they would prepare the place, make it clean. This cleaning of the place is the purification. And the rubbing the two woods placed in this way is the lower nature and the higher nature. And when they are brought in contact with each other, a fire is lit, not only in our soul, but also in the different parts of our nature. So in Shobindo's yoga, it's not just the soul escaping from the clutches of nature, but carrying nature in its ascension. The mind, assailed by the fire of the heavens, towers further and further, further and further. The heart ablaze with the divine love, experiencing the sweetness of the divine. It begins to grow wide and wide and lets its sweetness reach out to all like fragrance of a flower. The vital in man, the power of life, the force of life, no more cabined by the ego and the desired self. It begins to grow vast in its effort. Otherwise, our life is cabined in small efforts. An average person's life is, well, me, maybe my family, at most maybe my state, maybe my country, and in the farthest reaches mankind. Poor animals and plants are excluded, because it's after all mankind. So we discover an alien who is going to attack mankind, and we have to. But that is a smallness. When the vital, the life impulse grows vast, lit by the fire of yoga, then nothing is small. It's from the smallest elements right up to the gods. The working involves everything and everybody. And finally, the body itself, as the mother said, salvation is physical. It's not enough that we taste the nectar inside. This, of course, is, I'm sure, an experience which at least some of us would have had, been fortunate enough to have, of tasting the inner nectar, called in Sikhism as Amrit Chakhna. It's an inner nectar. It's not a, you know, something outside. It is the nectar which flows from the feet of the Lord. That's what Amrit is about. The bliss, the sweetness that come out of his heart and spill over into creation. And when we taste it, we discover the innate immortality. But what about our material nature? It is still predisposed to the same problems, same issues. And unless that changes, life upon earth will never change. So they took the real root of the problem. And the root of the problem is that matter refuses obstinately. It is where the bedrock of darkness lies. And matter itself under the grip of the subconscious nature, which doesn't allow it. Inner experiences we may have, wonderful experiences in trance, meditation, even while walking, remembering, doing japa, wonderful things can flow in. But when it comes to a problem with the eye or a problem with the heart, we look for a cardiologist and the Aravind Eye Hospital. This is our tragedy. And unless that changes, no fundamental change can abide upon earth. And the mother and Shobindo gave their life, their yoga, their tapasya, all their efforts to work upon this dimension. And that's why in this ashrama, we have playground, which is compulsory, more compulsory than meditation. You have a full-fledged playground, but you won't find a place where it is written meditation hall, though there is of course a place which is regarded as a meditation hall where people go and meditate. Meditation is everywhere, but playground is a special process. And why? Because this yoga, we have to work on both the ends, not only on soul, but on nature. Nature must be ready to receive the flame, the fire, the light, otherwise it will break down. Beautifully in Savitri, Shobindo reveals this when Ashupati is face to face with the Divine Mother and asks her to come down. O truth defended in thy secret sun, O wisdom, splendor, the eternal's artist bride. O bliss that ever dwellest, hid deep within, while men seek the outside and never find. What a ring of the Vedic lore is there in these lines. She says, tells Ashupati, that if this truth descends too soon, earth will break down. Man is too weak to bear the infinite's weight. What thou hast won is thine, but ask no more. Truth born too soon might break the imperfect earth. And yet, the boon is granted. Shobindo says at one place, the boon that we have asked from the Supreme is the most difficult of all boons. And yet the boon has been granted. This is what we talk about, the supramental descent on 29th February 1956. It's not an event to be celebrated every 4 years and forgotten. It is the birth of a new consciousness upon earth. And slowly but surely it is beginning to mold life. And all the things that we see today, from the outrage that we experience over crimes and murders and the mistreatment of women, to an uprising of the youth, to an upsetting of the norms, all these, and to a collective aspiration, to the fact that today here in this very hall, there are people from different countries who have gathered. All these are signs of an inner uprising, an uprising of the earth. I won't use the word revolt of earth. It's an uprising of the earth. Uprising of an earth towards a greater light, a greater truth. A truth which is no more cabined in sects and sectarianism, a truth which goes beyond all religious dogmas, a truth which is at once individual and collective, a truth which is the ancient of the ancient, and yet is the most newest of the new, because the earth has not tasted it and experienced it. The Vedic rishis glimpsed it, and yet we must taste it. And this truth is bound to overrun. First, it will break down many of the old patterns and norms of life. We see that today. A giant dance of Shiva toward the past. And yet, after that tearing of the past, Shobindo assures us, I saw the omnipotent flaming pioneers come crowding down the amber stairs of birth. Faces that wore a diviner, eyes approaching the eyes of a diviner man, lips chanting an unknown anthem of the soul. Such children are coming with a new software inbuilt in them. Soon after 56, in 58, the mother gave an interesting message. Material nature has agreed to collaborate. Which means every child that is born now is born with a chip, new chip. So it's no more a black sheep. We were the black sheep, and white sheep are being born amidst us. And they are going to be the massive barrier breakers and wrestlers with destiny in their list of will. Their tread one day shall change this suffering earth and justify the light on nature's face. So this is just a very brief, quick overview. It's an infinite Shobhinda's yoga, and to talk about it is to write Mahabharata of a Mahabharata, because it's not a yoga which is, you know, I often use this analogy. There is a swimming pool yoga where there is a fixed method. You have to start from this end and go to the other end. And there is a trainer and there is a lifeguard. This is one way of yoga. And there is another yoga which is like the ocean yoga. However much you are taught about it, you have to take the plunge. And when you take the plunge, it is disorienting, mind you. I had this direct experience. So let me share one experience, very material experience. But because the Veda is everywhere, it taught me a great truth about this yoga. So when I came here, I was enamored by the sea like many of us. But I didn't know sea swimming. And somebody dragged me there and said, it's very simple. Oh, is it? Nothing. You have to just let yourself go and the sea will support you. I said, sure, it's as simple as that. Yes, yes, yes. So I went waist deep or chest deep. And I, in all sincerity, let myself go. And the next thing I remember is seeing the floor and feeling, my God, this is my last moment on earth. Gasping for breath. The story of Sri Ramakrishna flashed after I came out. That he said, when then also you remember the divine, then the divine will appear. I said, my God, I lost the moment. But it was my lesson in yoga. Truly of let go, surrender. Surrender to the Divine Mother. We will feel disoriented. We will feel sometimes emerging on the crest of high rising waves. Touching the moon within our grasp. Nearing the sea as if it's us next door. At other times, we will feel the chill cold of the seabed. And after this waxing and waning, we will grow into the perfect integer of the soul. The Vedic Rishi spoke of the night and the days. These are the nights when we touch those parts of a nature, of universal nature, which are cold and dry and barren, like the Sahara. Perhaps Sahara still cacti bloom and there are mirages. But these depths of nature seem to be as if they have nothing. And yet, if we can feel the divine presence there and the love sustaining us, we are once again uplifted upward. And the next moment we experience once again the far winging reaches of the spirit. And that makes this yoga amazingly wonderful, interesting, and a fascinating journey of life, of creation, of earth towards the Supreme. It's not, yoga is not done by man for the sake of man. This is another big error. It is, yoga is done by the divine for earth. So what is the role of man? He can become a catalyst in the process of yoga of earth. All evolutionary emergence of life is the result of a secret yoga. Sri Krishna says, I have been doing this yajna from the beginning. I gave this yoga to Surya Vivaswan. And Arjuna says, sir, please, don't confuse me. How did you give to Surya? Because Surya is engaged in the yoga day and night. All life on earth is the result of action of this Surya. This is the original yoga. Sri Aurobindo brings back this original yoga. It is being done in earth. By whom? By the divine, who is hidden inside matter. When darkness was dense and covered with darkness, he was seated within it, immense and alone. And in man, this process becomes conscious. So the subconscious yoga of nature, which is anyways going on, becomes a conscious yoga in man. This is our role. Man is a dynamo for God's work. Nature does most in him. God the highest, only his soul's consent is his own. So we have to give this consent. And the mother assures us, if there is a sincere yes in your hearts, the hour can be now. The hour of transformation. Thank you.
Thank you, Alok Bhai, for this very inspiring, enlightening and insightful interpretation or insightful reconciling of the Vedic Yoga and Sri Aurobindo's Integral Yoga. So thank you once again. And before we close, I invite my colleague Shivakumar to extend the vote of thanks.
We have had a most wonderful evening today with the three beautiful speakers who have come here to share with us their life's experience. And it is a happy occasion for me to thank all of them. Initially, when Sampath introduced them, he started with a beautiful statement that how Vedas are the foundation of Sanatana Dharma. And when Dr. David Foley came to the podium, he in fact explained to us how the things started from Veda has now culminated in the beautiful integral vision of Sri Aurobindo. In fact, in his talk, he had explained to us how his own journey started from the West, but it did not take through the academic media, but he approached the Vedas directly. And during his exploration, when he started expressing himself, how it received the stamp of Sri Madhav Pandit from Sri Aurobindo Ashram, which became a source of encouragement for him to further dwell into the deeper mysteries of the Vedas. In fact, he explained to us some of the words, key words of the Vedas with their meanings and how we need to awaken the Manu, the divine word, the Surya, the illuminator, Agni, the divine will in us, so that what remains as the inner Veda is awakened and brought to the forefront and become our guide in this journey of light. And he concluded with two beautiful remarks that this Veda, which is available to us, is a heritage of the entire humanity. It doesn't belong to one particular set or one particular group, but it is a heritage that is left to us for the entire humanity. And in order to grasp and own that Veda ourselves, the path is first trying to have or acquire that inner stillness. And through that inner stillness, how one can help the Vedas to bloom within us. And that will take us to the revelations of further knowledge. And my first thanks, therefore, is to Dr. David Frawley, Pandit Vamadeva Shastri, on behalf of Sri Aurobindo Society and all of us here. It has been a most wonderful, illuminating talk. And next, it was Yogini Shambhaviji, who started by sharing a very beautiful experience that she has had before coming here. See, being in the ashram circle, I have grown up listening to the balcony darshan of the mother. But this is the first time I'm hearing the window darshan of Sri Aurobindo. And it was a most touching, most profound experience, which she decided to share with us. And thank you, Yogini Shambhaviji, for sharing this beautiful, sweet experience with us all. We had Dr. Alok Pandey here to share some of his insights of integral yoga. And in his beautiful talk, he started with the precarious position of the human soul. It is like our being able to glimpse the sky, but never being able to reach out and grasp the sky. It is there, we can sight it, but yet it seems to be out of reach. And how the evolution has been a journey of the soul's attempt to perhaps reach out to the sky and bring it down to where it is so that it can live the sky here on this earth. He also said in that attempt how the journey has progressed. See, what was in the Vedas was a beautiful truth brought down into our realm by the great Vedic rishis. And there have been subsequent attempts to synthesize into our lives. And it had happened in the Tantra, where Tantra took the application of it, the realization of these truths, into even places or at times where we would never imagine to be at such a place and such a time. And there was the attempt of the Gita to bring this light into even the battlefield, where a ghoram karma, even the most heinous act, the act of murdering people, killing people, is about to happen, and how spirituality was brought into this battlefield, and how Krishna gave this knowledge through Arjuna to the entire humanity. And through the further evolution, finally, there has been recently an attempt by several modern rishis to once again get back to the knowledge of the Veda, which somehow got separated from our everyday application. It got relegated into the background. And Sri Aurobindo very forcefully brought back the secret of the Veda in a language which is most modern, English, so that he, in a way, brought that knowledge which was so distant, so separated from us, to our very close proximity, and how he brought about a synthesis which is much needed for the modern times. And in his beautiful talk, Dr. Alok Pandey has said that the key is through the Divine Mother whom Sri Aurobindo himself brought forward as the key through which we ourselves can not only glimpse the truth, but the time has come for all of us to taste the truth. And in fact, he invited us not only to taste, but go and plunge ourselves into this truth, which will take us into a beautiful life. I thank Dr. Alok Pandey on behalf of all of us here and also on behalf of Sri Aurobindo Society. I thank every one of you too for having come here from the bottom of my heart. Thank you so much. Have a good day.